Hi, everybody. It's Friday, and that means it's time for another edition of Faculty Fridays. I'm here with my co-host, Tara Kay.
Hello, colleagues. How are you today?
And we have a very special show for you today. We're going to talk about space, everyone's favorite place. It's my favorite place.
Space is the place. I did a space show and played Sun Ra, that entire song, and it's about 12 minutes.
That's excellent.
I was pleased with myself. So today is a very special day, not just because we're talking about space, but it is Carl Sagan's birthday.
The one and only.
The one and only. Our childhood hero and still adulthood hero, I think. So it is technically Carl Sagan Day. And Carl Sagan, among a lot of other things, introduced us to the cosmos. And he...
Billions and billions.
he's the one who, I think, coined the term star stuff and had us realize that we are all made of the same thing. And we're going to focus today
apple pies from scratch.
We're going to play a special little treat that's off of YouTube to commemorate Carl Sagan, and then we'll get back into our star stuff, more of the mineralistic aspect of that star stuff with our special guest. Stay tuned.
I'm not very good at singing songs, but here's a try.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe. Space is filled with a network of wormholes. You might emerge somewhere else in space.
The sky calls to us. If we do not destroy ourselves, we will one day venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 million suns. A rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of exquisite interrelationships of the awesome.
I believe our future depends powerfully on how well we understand this cosmos, in which we float like a mote of dust in the morning sky.
But the brain does much more than just recollect. It intercompares, it synthesizes, analyzes, it generates abstractions.
The simplest thought, like the concept of the number one, has an elaborate logical underpinning. The brain has its own language for testing the structure and consistency of the world. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The sky calls to us. If we do not destroy ourselves, we will one day venture to the stars.
Thousands of years, people have wondered about the universe. Did it stretch out forever, or was there a limit? From the Big Bang to black holes, from dark matter to a possible Big Crunch, our image of the universe today is full of strange-sounding ideas.
How lucky we are to live in this time, the first moment in human history when we are, in fact, visiting other worlds.
A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. A rising of the Milky Way.
A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. A rising of the Milky Way.
Shore of the cosmic ocean. Recently we've waded a little way up, and the water seems inviting.
Welcome back to KPSU. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Faculty Fridays here on KPSU.org, quite possibly 98.1 FM on the PSU campus. My name is Tara Kay, and in the production booth I have my co-host Jeremy.
Hey.
Hey. So that, of course, was the wonderful theme for 2001, A Space Odyssey. Before that was Glorious Dawn, a compilation of Carl Sagan sayings put to music. Little Stephen Hawking thrown in there. And with us today is a wonderful professor from the geology department. This is Dr. Alex Ruzicka. Welcome, Alex.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. So we have obviously set the tone for space exploration, but we're probably going to stick to planet Earth for a little bit with our talk because, Alex, you study things that fall from space to Earth,
that's
correct?
Right. Meteorites.
Yes, you are not a meteorologist. You are a meteoriticist.
That's right.
Which is kind of, meteoriticist is a, actually it's a lot easier to say than you think it would be.
Do you feel any I don't know, anger or jealousy towards the meteorologists who got to steal that term, which really should be yours?
Well, you know, there's an interesting history to this. You know, it used to be thought, before we realized that rocks really did come down from space, that they were created in the atmosphere. And so we had things like, you know, igneous clouds. And so some people thought, oh, the meteorites are being generated in these big clouds and they're coming down. So it's kind of like that's all wrapped up in the name meteorology.
When did they think that there was this igneous cloud?
This was like in the early 1800s.
Okay, so that makes sense.
Yeah. So that's a while ago.
Could that actually happen? Because igneous rocks are formed from volcanic reactions. Igneous rock is the pumice and the scoria that you would find here in the Cascade Mountains. Is there any other way that could be formed?
Well, you know, it's not just on Earth, but other planets in the solar system can create these things. And so they're actually fairly common rock types. Huh. But so as far as we know, they're not generated in an atmosphere like the kind of planet that we have. Although if you had a really hot planet, you know, really, really hot, you might actually start condensing things that we would say as rock.
I have a feeling that if that were possible on a planet, the atmosphere would not be good to host
anything
that would want to breathe oxygen.
Very hot.
Yeah. Very interesting. Sure. So you are the director of the Cascadia Meteorology Meteorite
Not me. Catch you on that, dude.
Meteorite lab. And you have a whole bunch of meteorites at your disposal.
Yeah, that's probably something that most people, I'm sure, don't know, that Portland State hosts a meteorite collection, and it is a fairly unique and special thing. I can put it in context for you because there are maybe like, you know, a dozen different places across the country that have collections as nice as what we have. And so we have something really special right here in the Portland area, and you didn't even know about it.
Well, we keep finding really special things here in the Portland area, and we're really excited to bring them to public attention. I read that you have a bit over 600 specimens. Is that still accurate?
Yeah, we're actually closer to about 700 right now. Yeah.
Where is, I suppose, which specimen is from the strangest place, I suppose? I don't know if it's the strangest place on the continent or the strangest place on the planet that you found it, or... whichever one might be the most interesting to you. Maybe the one that you're hugging in your picture online.
It's hard for me to pick a favorite. You know, they all tell you something different. So it kind of depends on what I happen to be working on at the moment. You know, I get attached to certain meteorites when I'm working on them, and then I finish a project and I move on, and then the next one is really special. So I have a hard time picking, but... an interesting fact is that the most common kind of meteorite to fall onto the Earth is the one that is the most strange.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So we were in the early solar system when, before we had planets fully formed, we had other rocks forming like these types of meteorites, and they're known as chondrites. And they're kind of like a cosmic sedimentary rock, you know, this sort of shades of Carl Sagan, you know, but that's actually what they are. They form by sedimentary processes when we had gas and dust in the early solar system, the solar nebula, and we don't have those conditions anymore, so we can't make these kinds of rocks. But they're the ones that we get the most samples of from space, so they're kind of like a rock of the fourth kind, you know. They're not like standard igneous rock on Earth or a metamorphic rock or a sedimentary rock. before in space, early in the solar system, and only then under conditions that we can only imagine.
Wow. So they must be very old, I'm assuming.
Yes, yes. They date back to the beginning of the solar system. But that's true for most meteorites, too.
Mm-hmm. Are they the most common because they're so plentiful or because of Earth's orbit?
That's a good question. people have been arguing over that. Chances are it's a combination of there are a lot of them out there, but also they happen to be in orbits that are delivering the rocks to us right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For those of you who aren't really sure how meteorites fall to Earth, there's a big patch, I guess you could call it a patch or a cloud or something. There's a big collection of them that is within Earth's orbit, and that's why every year at the end of summer, early fall, we get a lot of meteorite showers because we pass through that and they get sucked in by our gravitational pull. Are there other times, or I guess maybe other spots within Earth's orbit that they're very plentiful?
Like what you're alluding to are the meteor showers that we think are mostly coming from little bits, like sand-sized particles that come off of comets.
Oh, okay.
And they don't make it down to the ground as an intact rock. So in order to be a meteorite, you have to make it through the atmosphere as a rock. Mm. And those other guys are so small, and they're coming in so fast that they burn up. So you see them as a nice show in the sky, but there's nothing left to study on the ground.
But did you say they're a sand-sized particle?
Yes.
And they create... and if they're coming from a comet, are they mineral or are they ice?
Both.
Okay.
So comets are probably made up of rocky material, what you would normally consider rocky, and ice. And so it's all coming in. And those are the things that create the showers that you're used to seeing. But there is evidence that meteorites come in streams, too. So it's the same deal. It's just that the rocks are fewer, and they're bigger. And so you have a chance of actually collecting them as a meteorite as opposed to the cometary debris.
Interesting. Yeah. Do the majority of your meteorites in your collection come from Antarctica?
No. Actually, almost none.
Really?
Yeah. We have been extremely successful at getting these meteorites by donations. Mm-hmm. That's how the collection has really grown. And we started up in about 2003 with one meteorite that belonged to Portland State. And, what we did, my colleagues, Melinda Hudson is the curator of the collection, and Dick Pugh is our meteorite outreach guy. And we were just eating dinner at our house. There's a story about how we all got together. We didn't know that Dick was here, and he didn't know that we were here and all that. But anyway, we finally met up, and we were talking after dinner, and it's like, why don't we create a lab? And, some people say, you can't just plant a flag, but that's what we did.
And seems to have worked out pretty well.
It worked out very well, and we conveyed to people, we are a place where we will preserve meteorites, we will grow the collection, we'll take care of them, and we'll study them. And that has resonated with people who have been very generous in their support and in their donations.
Are these scientists that you're colleagues with throughout the world, or are they amateurs who
mostly,
just happen to find them?
Mostly just people who are really interested in the subject. And for whatever reason, Portland has a lot of these people.
So are most of them from Cascadia?
Most of them are. Yeah. Well, no. you see, the meteorites come from various places and people acquire them, but then once they have them, they can give them to us. So we have a lot of things from Africa. Hmm. That's probably where we got most of our specimens from, is northern Africa, where there's good conditions for finding meteorites. And all around the world, actually. But Antarctica, not so much, because the only way you get an Antarctic meteorite is if you run an expedition.
Right.
And if you run an expedition, then it's government property, basically. And so it's not the sort of thing that you can just donate.
I see. Yeah. The reason I asked was because we have a lot of expeditions through in different departments that go to Antarctica.
Yes, including geology here.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I've heard that it's very easy to find meteorites there because it's so stark.
That's absolutely right. And every year there's a campaign to collect meteorites that's run by the United States National Science Foundation and NASA. And other countries do the same thing, like the Japanese do collecting expeditions as well. And so, we have many, many that are coming from Antarctica, but we have many, many that are coming from other places, too.
Very nice. So Dr. Ruzicka studied planetary science at University of Arizona. Before that, you got your master's at which school in New York?
SUNY at Stony Brook.
And what did you get your master's in?
Earth and space sciences.
Okay, so you went into this knowing pretty well that you were going to study meteorites.
Well, you know, no. it ended up that way, but actually I was always fascinated by space exploration. You know, when I was a kid, I watched the, you know, launches. You know, we were trying to get to the moon, so that kind of tells you how old I am. That's okay. But, you know, I was a product of the space age, basically, just after it started. And I was just fascinated by the exploration.
So it was space.
So exciting. It was
before
space.
The rocks.
Yeah, yeah. And then when we landed on the moon and we were bringing the moon rocks back, I thought, wow, you can learn about the origin of another body by picking up the rocks. Isn't this cool? And so I started learning about that, and you know, I wasn't that old, so I was just really interested in the subject. And then I thought, well, gee, you know, maybe I should take some geology classes in college. And, you know, plate tectonics was coming into vogue. You know, it was like becoming accepted at that point. And I thought, wow, you know, we have a planet that does this? Really? How neat is that? And so I was kind of hooked at that point. You know, it was rocks and space, rocks and space. And I kind of just ended up, I guess, falling into it, rocks from space, meteorites.
Very nice. And you went on to study at the University of Tennessee, Nashville.
Knoxville.
I thought I was saying that right.
Yeah.
Okay, so University of Tennessee, Knoxville, for your postdoctoral.
Right.
What did you finalize or specialize there?
It's been meteorites ever since SUNY Stony Brook. So I ended up working with Bob Dodd there, who was a meteorite guy, and then ended up going to University of Arizona. And still not being sure that I was going to keep working on meteorites, I ended up working with a meteorite guy, Bill Boynton. And then my path was kind of set at that point. You know, like having studied in graduate school meteorites, I was primed for it. And so that was what I was going to do.
And so how did you end up here starting the Cascadia Meteorite Lab?
Yeah, it's because my wife and I each took separate jobs after we were done with our PhDs. And she came here, and she works as a vested faculty at PCC Sylvania. And I went to Eastern Tennessee to work on my postdoc, and I said enough of that after 3 long years of a bi-coastal marriage. I said time is up for this postdoc. I'm going to Portland. And I arrived here, and I asked the geology department at the time, the chair, and I said, Ansel, could you give me an office with a phone, a desk and a phone? That's all I need. And I just took it from there.
Very nice.
That's
so
awesome.
You came here starting to teach just regular geology?
Any course I was offered, I started teaching. So I've taught like freshman, quarry, capstones, you know, and I worked my way through, and then I started teaching the classes that I was more passionate about, you know, more on my subject area, and just kept going.
So you teach a lot of courses here at PSU. Do you have a favorite one?
Well, you know, I teach a meteorites course, which is good for the specialty that I've got, and that's a great one for my students, you know, because they really learn, you know, the basics about meteorites before they start researching it, so that's a good class. I also teach a class which I really enjoy, but it's a little bit challenging. It's astrogeology, so it's a sort of the geology of the solar system. And what makes that one challenging is all of the missions that are going on with NASA. It keeps changing what we know about the solar system.
Actively changing the textbook as you go.
Yes, that's right. So there is no good textbook for that, actually.
That's my favorite thing. I'm a biology major, and the classes that I'm in now don't have textbooks because what we're learning hasn't even been published
that's
yet.
Right. Yeah.
Which is really exciting because you're on the cutting edge, and you are learning new things, and you're up to date with everything. Yeah. We were talking earlier about how curiosity has changed a whole lot of stuff, especially with what we're dealing with planetary geology.
Right.
So what are some of the things that have rocked your world since the Curiosity mission?
Oh, well, I'm kind of an addict, I'm afraid to say, about Curiosity and the other space missions. Right now, Curiosity is kind of my favorite one to check up on the NASA websites. And, you know, I track, they post the images every day, you know, when they get them back, and I start looking there, and I start doing instant geology. I was noticing that there was some funny things going on with those rocks there. They had some sort of an interesting texture, and then they kind of held back a little bit on the best data, but then they released it. What was surprising is that there's good evidence for conglomerate, and it's very obvious that it's conglomerate. There's, you know, it's a very distinctive rock type, and yet it's so important for understanding the geological history of the site in Gale Crater. What it says is that there was water that was flowing long periods of time. So it wasn't just a brief flood or anything. It was going on for a long time. And the water was able to erode and abrade the rocks and generate rounded rocks, the gravel-sized particles that then got incorporated in the conglomerate. And so that, just that discovery, you don't have to do any other measurements. You already have learned something fundamental, and it's basically just from photos. You know, they're coming back images. So, you know, they are going to probably be probing that story quite a bit more.
As a geologist, do you feel that you need to kind of get your hands dirty? I suppose you do. Do you like to be up and close and personal with what you're studying, or
yeah,
are pictures okay?
I like to be up close and personal, but with the new instrumentation that they have there, you do get up close and personal. They have one of my favorite new instruments that they have on Curiosity is called the Mars Hand Lens Imager. And this is a really cool camera. I don't know how they managed to get this thing. I know I take photographs, and I know how difficult it is to get, you know, depth of field and all that kind of stuff worked out. Well, they've got this camera, and it can focus, like, you know, within, like, a couple centimeters of something.
Wow.
So you get really close images. But it can also look off and way off into infinity.
Oh, wow.
And they have it mounted on the end of an arm. So just in the last week, they released a photograph, self-portrait of the rover.
I saw that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I saw that one too.
Isn't that neat?
Yeah.
I mean, we never had anything like that before.
Yeah.
It makes you feel like you're really there.
Yeah, it's really cool. And I love those pictures of just like the Mars landscapes. It's really magnificent and beautiful to look at.
They are beautiful. And they are an advance over what we had before, because it used to be that they would take pictures in different color wavelengths and then assemble them into color photographs. Well, if you go to the websites now, you'll see them already in color. So they're already pre-processed. They have computers that process the photos and just assemble them right there. So the raw images are already in color.
Yeah, it's amazing. And you, from what I understand, you can download anything that the Curiosity has taken, which is so cool if you just go to the NASA website.
Yeah.
So have you been in there kind of grabbing a bunch of photos and pouring through them?
Yeah, on my homepage I have a link to space missions. And, you know, by the end of this term I'm going to put up a link to the Curiosity so I can actually access them, other people can really fast.
Cool.
Okay, now, we should put a link up there too, Jeremy.
Sure, yeah, we'll do that.
We finally have our Facebook up and running.
What is our Facebook, by the way?
It doesn't have a slash.
Okay, great. We'll tell you next week.
we'll post it on the blog.
I have a quick question about going back to the meteorite collection. Is it open to the public in any way, shape, or form?
Not really. I get that question a lot. You know, people say, oh, like, where's your, like, display in Creamer Hall?
Yeah, because I would love to go look at some meteorites.
Well, actually, what we do have is we have a display that's open to the public at the Rice Mineral Museum, Rice Northwest Rocks and Minerals out in Hillsboro. And we put this together we had a NASA grant. This was kind of an outreach project. And we were very fortunate because as you go in the door there, and this is the premier collection of rocks in the Pacific Northwest, I would say. So we're very happy to be associated with them. And we agreed that we could put our display, we could create a display for them, and that they agreed to very generously help build this thing and put it right next to the front door. So everybody that goes there, including, you know, people who are, you know, you and me interested in the subject, or a lot of kids going on field trips.
Yeah, people going on field trips.
Yeah, so it's right there, and you can learn about meteorites. And there's a nice rock collection there that we...
Oh, that's great. That sounds really promising. Yeah. I'm from Los Angeles, and I used to frequent the Natural History Museum, and they have a huge gem vault. I would spend hours in there just looking at everything.
Yeah.
So I'm really glad to hear that Portland's going to have something like that soon.
Yeah. Awesome. So we don't have a display here at campus. What we have here at campus is the research lab and the collection that we use for research. But for a public display, we can point people to the Rice Museum.
Now, can any of your students have access to the lab?
Yes. So what we do is, you know, the collection is one room, and that's a secure room for obvious reasons. And so, you don't have ready access if you're a student, but there is another room that we have where we have a microscope set up, and the students can get into that one anytime they want.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah.
So are a lot of your specimens smaller?
Yes. Yeah, so we do have the 700, which is great, and it's got a lot of diversity, nice variety of different kinds of meteorites, but most of them do tend to be on the smaller side. So that's kind of the nature of how we built the collection. Other people have managed to get, big things because they were, you know, they had acquired it from somebody, and then they willed it to some place, you know, bequeathed it to some place. So they have a lot of big things. We do have a couple of big things, but mostly we have smaller rocks.
Okay. Yeah.
Cool.
And obviously these are very valuable because
yes.
of their origin.
Yes.
But do you have any particular samples that have very rare metals that might be that might make it even more astounding?
I consider it more scientifically valuable than commercially, although you could mine these things. You know, they have a lot of valuable materials in them. If you could find big enough meteorites, they would be a good resource for people. But mostly I think it's, you know, because they're kind of precious.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to cut them up and, you know, sell them or, you
Obviously.
Know, melt them down. So it's more of a, they just, the secrets that they hold for the formation of the solar system. And they even, many of them contain things that formed before our solar system formed. They're pre-solar grains. And this is a revolution in our thinking that we just realized in the last couple of decades that there are these things. And so they actually contain bits of of other stars.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
That's
yeah.
amazing.
Yeah. So, you know, when you think of it that point of view, it's like that's much more valuable. We can study about astrophysics from looking at these pre-solar grains, studying their compositions, so we can understand something about how stars work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that that's really neat. And like, how did life begin? Because, you know, you don't have life in the rocks, but you find the compounds that are used by life, and they formed in space.
Do you have an opinion on that as far as the theory that meteorites brought life to, or at least organic molecules?
Panspermia is the kind of the traditional word for that, where life began somewhere else and then was delivered here. And I would say the chances are good, in the sense that the compounds that life needed were coming down onto Earth in a big way at the beginning of the solar system. As far as we know, as soon as we have a rock that we could date, there was evidence for life for it on the Earth, and this is while we're having sterilizing impacts. And there's some connections with the kinds of molecules, organic molecules, that we're finding in these meteorites and the kinds of things that we have here on Earth to suggest that there is a link. So I think that there is a contribution, but exactly the nature of that contribution has not been figured out yet.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So being a planetary scientist, I assume that you study other planetary systems.
I do to some extent, yes. So I'm watching with everybody else all the discoveries of extrasolar planets. It's another one of these things that's hard to keep up with.
Yes. I heard there was one very recently.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, all
like
the time.
A couple days ago, a large Earth-like planet. I don't know if you know anything about that.
Not that particular one.
Yeah.
But there's going to be Earth-like planets discovered, there's no doubt. So yeah. I think that's one of the surprises is how many planets there are. That was a big debate. Now we know there's you know, billions and billions of them, as Carl Sagan would say.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't look, the other solar systems don't look like ours. So that's a surprise, too. We kind of figured there's a certain way of making a solar system, and we're it. And now we're finding, actually.
I don't know if it's this one that we just mentioned, but I know there is a planet in a habitable zone that is revolving around two suns.
Yeah.
So, that's a good example
of how things.
It's just totally
yes.
different.
Yes,
incredible.
Yeah, it's
yes.
very interesting. Well, why don't we take a quick break? We are going to play a song chosen by Alex here. Which one is this one that we're playing, Jeremy?
We're going to play Rocket Man.
Ah, perfect. This is Elton John for you guys.
Packed my bags last night, pre-flight. 0 hour, 9 a.m. And I'm gonna be high as a kite by then. I miss the earth so much. I miss my wife. It's lonely out in space. On such a timeless flight, and I think it's gonna be a long, long time. The touchdown brings me round again to find I'm not the man they think I am at home. Oh, no, no.
kids. In fact, it's cold as hell, and there's no one there to raise them. If you did, and all the science I don't understand, it's just my job 5 days a week. A rocket.
This is Mike from Chicago's own Mutts. You're listening to Portland's college radio station, KPSU 98.3 FM.
Hi, I'm Olive.
My name is Simon.
Hi, my name is Carrie.
Hi, I'm Dylan.
Listen to the AM Rush on Fridays.
Hang out with us and start your weekend right.
The AM Rush Friday mornings. Fake news, fun, and great music.
Tune in 8 to 10 every Friday morning for the AM Rush.
On KPSU, Portland's college radio.
The student food pantry at PSU is located in Smith Student Union, room 325. It is open to all students Monday through Friday from noon to 2 p.m. No ID is required, and there are no questions asked. We welcome any student facing any hunger issues. Come on down. Would you like to donate food or volunteer your time at the student food pantry? You can bring non-perishable food items and hygiene products to University Studies in Kramer Hall 117. Volunteers can contact Erica at eschnatz@pdx.edu or call 503-725-2203. You can follow the PSU Student Pantry on Twitter, ASPSU Pantry. We will be collecting donations in University Studies through November 12th. Hope to see you there.
KPSU would like to thank the Portland Mercury for their support. Found at hundreds of locations all over Portland, the Portland Mercury features articles, news, columns, food and drink, music, art, film, theater, books, and more. For more information, visit www.portlandmercury.com.
In the mid-1980s, a punk commando unit was sent to a musical prison by a military court for a music they didn't destroy. These men promptly escaped from a maximum security stockade to the Portland, Oregon underground. Today, still wanted by the government, they survive as DJs of fortune. If you have music, if no one else will play it, and you know where to find them, maybe you can listen to Life Support, Punk Rock at the Crack of Noon. Sundays at noon on KPSU.org and 98.1 on the FM dial. Hosted by Jimmy Ty Chastain and Mr. Plow, a.k.a. Little P-Lo.
And we're back. Welcome back to Faculty Fridays. We are here with Alex Ruzica, geologist and Portland State professor. I'm Jem, and that's my co-host, Tara Kay.
Hello. So, Dr. Ruzica, you are technically a geologist,
meteorologist.
I don't know why I can't say that word. Every time I start to say it, I'm like, don't say meteorologist. Don't say meteorologist. So you're that thing. You're also a geochemist and a geochemist, a cosmochemist, which means earth and space, obviously, the different chemistries there. You're also a petrologist, which was a word that I learned today. Could you explain what a petrologist is?
Yeah, petrologist is somebody that studies how rocks were formed. So I consider myself to be a petrologist because I study the meteorites, the rocks, and try to understand how they formed. But I'm also a geochemist and a cosmochemist because I use the principles of geochemistry and extend that into space. That's the cosmochemistry part of it, to understand these things. So I make chemical measurements, microchemical measurements on things. I also consider myself to be kind of a mineralogy person, a mineralogist, because I study the minerals and the characteristics of those minerals in the rocks. And so, yeah, I guess I could call myself a lot of different things, and an astrogeologist, and yeah.
Yeah, we were just speaking over the break about, I asked what his favorite mineral was. It was olivine?
It's olivine, I'd say, because I've studied it. It's a common mineral in the meteorites, and it's actually a nice one, too. You know, there's a certain type of a meteorite known as a pallasite, which is made up of big olivine crystals that you can see with your eye really easy.
Oh, yeah.
And it's in a matrix of metal alloy, and they're beautiful. They're just absolutely beautiful. They look fake, but they're, you know, they were actually created, you know, in the beginning of the solar system by processes.
As you were saying that, that kept nagging on my brain as if I knew what you were talking about. And I've seen those. I saw a picture very recently. It's just this glob, and you can hold it up to the sun, and it shines this beautiful green.
Right.
And then you see this web of, a silvery metal.
Yes, that's exactly right. So if you cut your slice of a palisade thin enough, the light shines through the olivine but doesn't go through the metal. Metal's opaque, and it won't let the light go through.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And you know, I've got some really nice pictures of these things. I've gotten very good at taking pictures of meteorites. And, one of the nicest ones that I've gotten, I think, that's very striking is a picture of the palisade where you can see some of the light coming through the olivine, but you can also see the sky reflection on the metal. So it's just multicolored.
Oh, neat.
Beautiful.
Yeah. That is so cool. So for you non-geology buffs, I just want to go over really quickly the four types of rock. There are three types of rock, well, four types of rock here. There is the sedimentary, which is the layers. There's the metamorphic, which are rocks like granite. And then there's the igneous, which you all should be familiar with. That's the lava rock, essentially. And then there is the composite material, which is
chondrite.
The chondrite. Is chondrite composite?
It is, yeah.
Okay.
It's the technical name for it is agglomerate, but that's essentially composite because different things formed different ways and came together.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of like what can happen in some sedimentary rocks, like a conglomerate on Earth can form, or the conglomerate that we found on Mars recently with Curiosity. Same principle, but of course those are on planetary surfaces. With the chondrite, these are things that formed in space before there were planets.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little different setting.
So what is the difference between, Earth-formed conglomerates and then the chondrites? What are the properties that are different, physical properties?
Well, a conglomerate on Earth would be composed of gravel-sized pieces of things, rocks, that have been eroded, abraded by water, usually. So they get round shapes, and then those get transported by a stream, get deposited in the low area. Or, they can get transported to the beach and you can have wave action. You get the gravels there. But if it forms a rock, then it's a conglomerate. And it tells you that there's been a lot of water processing.
Mm-hmm. And it's a bit like concrete in its kind look.
Yeah, except you got the things. Yeah, I guess so. Like if you got the concrete that have the pebbles in them, that's exactly right. But then the chondrites are much finer grained, and they have not been shaped by the water flowing, or there's nothing to do with streams.
Right.
So they're little bits of things, and yet they have little, they've been described as spherical, but they're not always spherical. These things called chondrules, and they're bits of igneous rock, but they were apparently like little floating bits of molten rock.
Oh, neat.
In space.
Cool.
And they just got mashed together with other
stuff. They got mixed up with even finer things and rock fragments and stuff to make the chondrites that we now have.
That is just
very
insane.
Cool.
The pressures and the temperatures with that must be astronomical.
Very different. Yes. Very different conditions.
Yeah. So I wanted to set that up with the quick introduction of different rocks, because we're now going to shift to things here. Really, we're going to talk about seismic activity, since that's kind of been, bubbling around the Cascadia mines. I know every minute that I have to spend suspended over the Selwood Bridge makes me a little bit more paranoid about the big earthquake.
Understandably so.
Me too.
Because I know when it hits and I'm on the Selwood Bridge, I'm going to fall into the water.
When we drive over that, our kids now say, oh, let's get across here. They're 5 and a half.
And they're concerned about it too. So how does Cascadia look as far as...
Why don't we start at the beginning? You want to tell us about the Cascadia Fault and the expected earthquake that's coming up?
Well, it actually is a nice tie into the name of our lab, right? We're the Cascadia Meteorite Laboratory, and we came up with that name because it's the whole Pacific Northwest. You know, so we weren't thinking the Portland Meteorite Laboratory. We were talking the Cascadia Meteorite Laboratory, and there is this major structure here in the Pacific Northwest, which goes all the way from Mendocino, California, up to British Columbia, southern British Columbia. And we have one tectonic plate. That's the plates that are on the surface of the Earth are moving around relative to one another. The topmost rigid part of the Earth is these form these plates. And we have one offshore here, the Juan de Fuca plate. It's one of the smaller ones of the big plates. And it is being thrust underneath the North American plate. And so when you have that happen, you have a lot of force building up. One plate going underneath another one is not something that's easy, but it's constantly being pushed. As it's pushing, it's building up pressure. It's actually raising up the land surface a little bit on the North American plate where we live. It's going up, and eventually, that can't go on forever. It's going to collapse when we have an earthquake. And when we have that earthquake, obviously, we can have a lot of destruction. And these sorts of earthquakes along subduction zones, they're called, are the most powerful earthquakes that we can generate on the Earth. And we happen to be living right over an area where we have these sorts, this sort of potential. And it's worse here than it is in places like California, where everybody knows, oh, yeah, you live in L.A. and you got earthquakes. There you have so many earthquakes that really is the pressure. But here we build.
Oh, interesting.
We haven't had the little ones to kind
That's
of
right.
dissipate
yeah.
that.
Huh? That's right. So it builds, and then when it happens, it's really bad.
So what sort of magnitude are we expecting out of this thing?
Oh, I'm not an earthquake expert, but I know what the geologists say, and they say you could be talking 8 or 9,
oof,
which is monstrous.
Yeah, that's
that
huge.
That is monstrous.
Because
so,
if I understand the Richter scale properly, it's an exponential scale.
That's right. It's
so like, the change from 7 to 8 is a whole huge exponential degree.
Yes. Yeah. It's like multiple, it's factors of 10 type differences. You go up by number rather than just one.
Yeah. So that's big. That's really big.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it is a concern. And, people say, oh, that's like, you're like exaggerating. Well, I mean, we have a record of previous big earthquakes here, and some of the other people in the geology department study this, and they can see evidence for giant tsunamis deposits. And so we know it's a real problem.
So if... when there is the big earthquake here, are we going to have a tsunami?
Well, the coast would have the tsunami problem. I don't think that Portland itself would have the tsunami problem,
right,
but we would have the shaking problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay. So when this happens, then the smaller plate that is subducting into the North American plate will cause the wave to come hit the western coast of America?
Yeah. So the pressure builds up until finally the rock basically breaks. And when the rock breaks, then you have an earthquake. And then that sends seismic waves out in all directions.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are the seismic waves that we would be worried about, because once those hit Portland, we would be shaking and swaying Yeah, you know, it was kind of interesting because I actually experienced my first earthquake up here in, while I was teaching a class in Kramer Hall. And I was in the corner room there, and I was teaching a global environmental change class, so I teach climate change, and I had just finished talking the week before about earthquake hazards in the Northwest, and the students go, yeah, right. And then we had the earthquake, and we were in the corner of, like, the second floor. So we're up on the corner, and boy, did the building sway.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, oh, my gosh, you know, this is not going to, and that was a small quake. And what happens if we have a big one?
Yeah, it's going to be pretty devastating.
It's going to happen to the campus buildings.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
So what can we as the layman do to prepare for this? If anything, other than just hide in a corner in the fetal position and cry about it.
You can buy earthquake insurance for your house if you happen to own a house. that's one thing you can do. I actually have that. So my wife and I, we teach this stuff, and so we both said, yeah, let's get it.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
You can put pressure on your elected officials to take it seriously. You know, we're doing the upgrade of the schools now, seismic upgrade. We've recently upgraded.
Right, I remember hearing about that.
The SRTC building here, you know, seismic upgrade. So those sorts of things are useful to do.
As I understand, they're upgrading a lot of elementary and middle schools as well, yeah, and public schools all over the city.
Yeah, it's a good idea to do that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, bottom line is if you have a big quake here, even if you've upgraded the buildings, you know, it's going to be devastating.
Should we go outside? Should we get into an open space, or should we stay in the building? Get in a door frame, get under a table.
Yeah, I think, you know, people mostly say get under a door frame if you can. It's a little bit stronger. They actually do have some, I saw in the Oregonian, I think it was last week, they had a photograph of, in some schools, they're designing these sort of safe zones, earthquake safe zones. Mm. They're not like the entire building upgraded, but they're kind of like a core or a beam like that's safe. And they have it designated so that you can see it from the hallway, so you know that's one of the safe zones. And things like that might be useful to do. You know?
Makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was informed that getting under tables and getting under things is actually a terrible idea, because when something falls on that table, it's going to...
That thing falls on you.
It's going to fall on you. So the best thing to do is to look for all of the angles in your house. Find a place where if your ceiling or wherever you are is going to fall... Find a corner that will kind of create a triangle, so when this large piece of plaster or concrete or whatever falls, it's going to tilt down, so you can have that little space where you can hide under that.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's a problem, you know, and people don't see what makes it the real problem is that people don't think about it here, because it doesn't happen all the time. If you live down in L.A., it's something you think about because it happens all the time,
right,
and you take steps to make things safe.
Uh-huh.
Do you know if they do earthquake drills in elementary schools around here? Are they still doing that?
No, I don't think
so. Prepared?
Yeah.
As far as I know,
we did them every year in L.A. And I know.
Actually, I take that back. They are doing earthquake drills in some schools. I don't know if they do it in all public schools.
Well, we had the citywide earthquake drill a few weeks ago. Did you guys know about that?
No,
I didn't.
Yeah, I heard about it that day, a couple hours beforehand. But a lot of people participated, and that they shut down different parts of downtown and kind of just had this mock earthquake drill.
Cool.
Yeah,
that's
cool. Which is great, but I kind of wish I had participated in it now.
I wish I'd known about it.
I know. So being from Southern California, I've dealt with the San Andreas Fault, which runs, longitudinally, which means the plates are going not one under the other, but they're sliding side to side,
right,
kind of.
That's
making
correct.
This movement with my hands that you guys can't see. But they're going like up and down. And so how does that differ? Because I know the San Andreas Fault about the Bay Area runs off into the ocean. And then is that something that will
it's,
affect
see, that's
us
a,
as well?
So that's a plate boundary between the Pacific plate on the west and the North American plate on the east. So what in western L.A., they're actually in the Pacific Plate, and different than the rest of the country, along with Hawaii. Hawaii's on the Pacific Plate. And so it's moving sideways, like you're saying, right there. But then that boundary, you trace it up past San Francisco, goes up to Mendocino, then takes a sharp curve out into the ocean. And that's where we get the beginning of the Juan de Fuca Plate that I was mentioning. So, so actually that is connected to all of this. So, you know, the plate boundaries are all connected up. in different ways. And so we happen to have the configuration where one plate's going underneath the other one here, but down in LA, like you said, it's kind of a sideways motion. It's not happening. You don't have subduction there.
Mm-hmm.
It's why you won't get volcanoes
mm-hmm.
in LA. Despite what you've seen in movies, that just does not happen at one of those kinds of plate boundaries. That's just a sideways motion. You know, it can generate shallow earthquakes, but that's all it does.
Mm-hmm. Is there any way that an event could happen to where all three plates will interact with each other in a very catastrophic way?
That's called a triple junction. You know, you do have places where you have triple junctions. So that down in Mendocino, you have a triple junction, and other than earthquake activity, it's nothing that different from, say, the San Andreas Fault.
Mm-hmm.
It just happens that you have kind of a different boundary created there, and it goes off.
So I know that there is no way to predict an earthquake at all.
Right.
Japan thought that they had something that's mm-hmm. very close, but it's only like 15 minutes before a big one actually
right.
hits. Do you think that there's a way that we could start to, by gaining more data from earthquakes, that we could actually predict an earthquake?
Yeah, that's a tough one. Earthquake prediction is a really tough thing. And I think, you know, it's always couched in terms of probability. So, you know, you can't say, like, it's going to happen here at this particular time, but you could say, like, statistically speaking, from analysis of the previous record, there's a certain chance. And that's kind of like what we have now. You know, I've been hearing quotes of, you know, we're approaching 50% chance in the next, you know, couple hundred years to have a big subduction earthquake. But that doesn't mean that it's going to happen. It could be mm-hmm. 1,000 years, you
yeah.
know, or it could be tomorrow. And so you don't really know. It's
yeah.
all terms of probability.
That's so hard. I don't know if they've let him go finally, but have you heard about the news with the Italian seismologist that they jailed for not predicting
yeah.
an earthquake?
Yeah, I read that and I could not believe that.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, you know, like, wow.
Yeah,
a little scary.
So absurd. I don't even know how that happened.
All right, well, we're running in towards the end of the show, and we do have one more song we wanted to play. I'd love for you to introduce the song. This is REM's It's the End of the World as We Know It. And you had said that this might relate to a potential intergalactic or interstellar
yeah.
collision were we to get hit with a large
yeah.
floating body in space.
Yeah, so this is a real concern that we have all these things that are in orbits that are intersecting the Earth. And if you have a big enough rock hitting the Earth, that is a major problem. And, you know, it's what set the, you know, it's what helped us in evolution. The dinosaurs
mm-hmm.
got killed off 65 million years ago.
Yeah.
Mammals became ascendant after that with one of these guys. And you know what? It was only 10 kilometers across.
Oh, my goodness.
But
wow.
there's so much kinetic energy because these things are moving so fast that it's just, you know.
Right. Back to what you were saying about the sand grain size of the meteor.
Yeah, they're moving very fast.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you have all that speed, then that becomes a problem. So. And we know that there are things that are getting awfully close to Earth, and
yeah.
wow.
it makes it a little bit uncomfortable. So, yeah, we could have a serious problem on our hands in the future.
And the cockroaches will take over.
And yeah. it would be the end of the world as we know it. Thank you so much for joining us, Alex Ruzicka.
You're welcome.
We'll, we'll talk to you soon. We'll see you next week.
Be sure to tune in next week. We have Dr. Kenneth Stedman from Virology coming in. He also says hello to you, Alex.
Hi, Ken.
All right. Thanks
for
tuning
listening.
In.
That's great, it starts with an earthquake. Birds, snakes, and aeroplane. Lady Bruce is not afraid. I am a hurricane, listen to yourself. Turn world, serve its own needs. Dummy, serve your own needs. Speed it up an ox speed. Grunt, no strength. The ladder starts to clatter with fear. Fight down, hide, wire and a fire. Represent the seven games. Government for hire and a combat site. Left or western coming in a hurry with the furies breathing down your neck. My team reporters babble, trunks, tethered crops. Look at that little land, find them. Overflow, population, common food. But it'll do to save yourself, serve yourself. World serves its own needs, listen to your heart. Lead dummy with the rapture and the reverend and the right. Right, chief, vitriotic, patriotic, slam, book, neck, right. Feeling pretty sight. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. Don't get caught in foreign towers, flash a burn, return, listen to yourself, turn, locking in, uniform and book, burning blood, letting every motive escalate, automotive, incinerate, light a candle, light a photo, step down, step down.
watch a heel crush, crush. Uh-oh, that means no fear. Cavalier, renegade, steer clear. Tournament, tournament, tournament of life. Offer me solutions, offer me alternatives, and I decline. It's the end of the world as we know it. Cheesecake, jelly bean, symbiotic, patriotic, slam, book, net, right?
Right.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. And I feel fine. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it.